From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the outlines of a classic big power proxy fight in Syria, only not so proxy. U.S. and Russian jets are now waging two air wars at once over the same country. Russian fighter jets have hit American-backed rebels. Syrian rebels are now taking out Russian-made tanks with American-made missiles. To many eyes, a bold Russia has suddenly breezed past. A hand-wringing U.S. changed the game, called Washington's long bluff in Syria. This hour On Point, Russia's big power play in Syria, America's response, and where this goes. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on what is playing out here. Is this Putin's coup de grace to American global prestige or a big, dumb move? Where does this end? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Turkey's capital, Ankara, is Erin Cunningham, Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. She was in Beirut for the last couple of weeks covering Russia's entrance into the Syrian civil war. She was dispatched to Ankara to cover the bombing of a demonstration there this weekend. Erin Cunningham, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Does it appear so far that Russian support from the air is turning the tide for Assad's forces against the rebels on the ground?
Well, it's certainly putting pressure on the rebels. Now, there hasn't been a large chunk of territory that's been retaken by the Syrian regime yet, but there's definitely a lot of heavy fighting. They've moved into areas that the rebels were. They lost those areas again. So the battle has intensified, certainly, but I do think that as it goes on, that we'll see more progress by the Syrian government in these areas.
Where is or has Russia been aiming the bulk of its firepower?
Well, most of it's happening in a province called Hama, which is near a regime stronghold in western Syria. And that's where a lot of Free Syrian brigades, groups that the U.S. vetted, have received TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles. That's where most of the fighting has gone on, there and moving into Idlib province, which is in the north.
And are Syrian forces on the ground establishing beachheads against there? Do we see, if not major territory lost by the rebels, do we see them at key points being turned back or under pressure?
Yeah, I think so, but it's too difficult to tell at the moment. They haven't been pushed out of any large areas. They're also fighting in new areas and valleys near Latakia, which is where the Alawite community has its largest population. So while these key areas are being fought in, we haven't seen either side make gains or be pushed out.
Latakia, where Russia has now also, of course, put in their new air base. What about the ratio of Russian airstrikes against ISIS versus anti-Assad rebels?
I think that this is something that the U.S. Defense Secretary has talked about as well, and it appears, and this is based on reporting on the ground and from activists who are there, that most of the strikes are against anti-Assad rebels and that very little strikes have taken place against the Islamic State. In fact, we haven't seen any specific instance where that's happened. There's no clear location where a Russian strike has taken place against an Islamic State target.
So just to put it plainly, what does it appear to you, Erin, as a reporter, that Russia is up to right now in Syria?
Well, I think what they're doing is they're carving out an area around Latakia province where the regime is strong in order to provide the Syrian government strategic depth that in case rebels make further gains, that they can defend that area. Now, that's the first, I think, the first goal of what Russia is doing in Syria, to defend the regime, to make sure that Assad doesn't fall and he has a place to go in western Syria. If they gain the momentum, then I think they will try to push rebels out of Hama province and maybe even in areas of northern Syria where rebels, including the Nusra Front, which is linked with al-Qaeda, are more strong.
And what about a Russian endgame here? They, of course, have supported the Assad regime for many years, before this Assad, under his father as well. What about an endgame now? Could their interests at some point line up and be parallel with American interests or not?
Well, I think it's difficult to say. I think their first target, obviously, is the rebellion against Assad, and that if that was eventually defeated you know, the fighting was tempered a bit, that they may turn towards ISIS as a secondary target. And if that was the case, then their interests, yes, they would align with the U.S. But I see that as a long way off. And right now, it's just not clear that their primary target is the Islamic State.
We're hearing more and more about proxy war between the U.S. and Russia. Does that appear to be shaping up to you, Aaron? These anti-tank missiles that are there, American-made, but many have come through the Gulf states. Is the U.S. suddenly pumping much more toward the anti-Assad rebels, which would, in effect, be taking the opposite side of Russia? Or are these Saudis and others stepping it up?
Well, I think the Saudis and others are stepping it up, but the tank missiles that have been going into Syria for quite some time now were supplied to the Saudis by the U.S. and sort of have that stamp of approval that they're going in and that they will be given to anti-Assad rebels. So I think by default they're involved in a proxy war, but it's difficult to say how much dedication that the U.S. has towards the rebels, and I think they're more interested, as we've seen yesterday, in arming the Kurdish militias and the other groups that are interested in fighting the Islamic State.
Aaron, you're based in Cairo. You've just been in Beirut for a couple of weeks as this ramped up. Now you're in Ankara. You've been talking with people over a wide arc there. What are you hearing? Does Russia look potent or reckless here? Does the U.S. look impotent or feckless here to the region?
I think that yes, there is this idea that Putin is much stronger, that Russia is much more interested in fighting the Islamists. They've done a good job of sort of painting the entire rebellion as being, you know, extreme Islamists, Sunni extremists that are linked with the Islamic State, and I think that people are unsure what the U.S. wants and which side that they're on. So yes, I would say that there is support for Russia in the region. How long that will last, it's unclear once, you know, it becomes more clear what the Russians are doing in Syria. But for now, yes, Putin is certainly popular and the Obama administration less so.
Aaron Cunningham, Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, joined us from Ankara, Turkey today. Aaron, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It didn't take any time at all for critics of the Obama administration to jump on all this. Here was John McCain a couple of weeks ago with Newsmax talking about the whole situation, the foreign policy that's allowed Vladimir Putin to jump in big in the Middle East.
It's a result of a feckless foreign policy. You can go back to his failure to accept the advice of his national security advisors to arm the Free Syrian Army. You can go back to the red line in Syria where he said that he was going to act and didn't. You can go back to a pattern of behavior that rejects American leadership and displays American weakness. And Vladimir Putin and Bashar Assad are taking advantage of it.
On Sunday, talking with 60 Minutes, Steve Croft, President Obama said Russia's hurting itself and not the United States with its actions in Syria.
He's challenging your leadership, Mr. President.
No,
he's challenging your leadership.
Steve, I got to tell you, if you think that running your economy into the ground and having to send troops in order to prop up your only ally is leadership, then we've got a different definition of leadership.
Let's step back and look at what's going on with us right now from Washington. Robert Satloff, Executive Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Robert Satloff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from London, Jeremy Shapiro is with us. He's with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, former advisor to the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, on North Africa and Levant, the Syrian region, under President Obama. Jeremy Shapiro, thank you for joining us from London.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Satloff, what do you make of what's unfolding right now with Russia's ramp up in Syria?
Well, I think we just heard a very insightful report from Aaron Cunningham. I think she identified the top of a series of Russian priorities, which is to protect and defend Assad, the Assad regime, and what the Assad regime represents. I don't think we should ascribe to Vladimir Putin any romantic attachment to Bashar al-Assad. It's not as though Assad is a necessary partner, but it's what he represents, and he represents stability. He represents the fact that regimes cannot fall, should not fall to their opponents, whether they're Islamic radicals or whether they're Democrats. It really makes no difference to Putin. And in this case, it is Putin reversing the legacy of America's overthrow of Gaddafi, which he opposed and which he thought was a terrible evil. It is Putin reenacting, in some sense, what he did in Crimea and Ukraine, taking a slice of territory and ensuring that it's defended and protected. And it is Russia moving into a vacuum. He seems to know what he wants. We do not seem to know what we want. He is putting assets to protect his interests, and we are in a fog. And the region recognizes this.
Jeremy Shapiro, is Putin reckless? Is Washington feckless?
Yeah, one out of two, I suppose. I do think that Putin is being quite reckless. I agree with what Dr. Satloff just said in terms of describing his motives, but I think what we have to assess is whether he's really going to achieve any of those things by these motivations. I think that when we, you know, when we sort of write headlines for foreign policy, we tend to sort of approve of the bold, and we tend to sort of say, well, you know, this looks great, it's strong, it's purposeful, it demonstrates strength. This is a sort of kind of machismo approach to foreign policy, which is very common in both the United States and Russia, I guess. But, you know, I mean, if we had assessed who was on top of the sort of boldness charts in, say, April of 2003, we would have said the United States. But it didn't work out that well because it wasn't a very well-conceived, albeit bold, initiative. I think we have the same.
Talking the Iraq war there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Iraq war. I think Vladimir Putin has the same problem. He doesn't have the strength, either at home or abroad, to really carry out the type of project that Aaron Cunningham described. I think he can do pretty well for a few months, but I think that that the Russians will get bogged down, and they will start to regret this and start to look for ways to cut their losses.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russia's big power play in Syria, the U.S. response, and where all this could go. You can join us this hour. What do you see Russia doing in Syria? What should the U.S. do in response? Retreat? Confront? Coordinate? Does Russia look reckless here or smart? Does the U.S. look weak, at a loss, bumbling, or keeping an appropriate distance? We say distance. Of course, U.S. jets are in there as well. They've been bombing ISIS off aircraft carriers and more lately out of Turkey. Russian planes over Turkish airspace. NATO complained. Turkey, of course, NATO member. These things get really complicated in a hurry. This was the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg in Norway on Monday warning Russia about its actions in Syria and over NATO member Turkey.
It's an unacceptable violation of Turkish and NATO airspace and about Russia's substantial military buildup, its air strikes, and its cruise missile attacks. Russia should play a constructive role in the fight against ISIL. To support the Assad regime is not constructive. This is only prolonging the war in Syria.
Okay, says Vladimir Putin, but if you want to get rid of terrorists, work with us. Here he was, Putin, talking with state-run television over the weekend, saying U.S. and Russian military forces should collaborate in Syria. The Russian leader saying if they really know better and want to fight terrorism, let the U.S. tell us the specific places where terrorists are hiding, where their headquarters and warehouses with weapons and equipment are. Give us the target, says Putin. What can be easier? What can be easier? Jeremy Shapiro, is this a big black eye for the Obama administration? Does it look like they've just been dithering all these years, uncertain about what to do, and now they have no good options, and Russia's in there cutting a swath?
I think that politically it's obviously a black eye. That's clearly the narrative within Washington. I think when it comes to Syria policy, though, which is, you know, more what I would be looking at, it's you know, it's a reflection of the fact that this is a big problem, that the Russians think they have a solution, but they probably don't, and that the United States never really had a solution, an approach that could work. And I think that it's tough to be president, and everybody likes to sort of criticize him for whatever outcome comes along. But I think we have to accept in the Middle East at this point, at least, that not everything is in our control. and that events there can spin out of control without the United States either being at fault or having the responsibility to solve them. And I think we need to, President Obama has been trying to push us to that position, but obviously, you know, John McCain hasn't come along with him.
Robert Sutloff, that is a new message to American ears. It may have been manifest that we couldn't solve everything, but this is not what American leaders have said very often. They've certainly dived in the 20th century into very big conflicts and come out with victories and solutions. Americans remember that well. Are we at a regional turning point in terms of influence here? Are we at a global turning point?
Well, let's unpack this a little bit. It is clear that there is more than just a Russian challenge. If we look at the fact that Russia has now reached an arrangement with Iraq, with Iran, with Hezbollah, with the government of Assad, that means that from the Mediterranean all the way through Iran, there is a form of alliance. This is a serious strategic challenge to the United States. That's point one. Point two is, this is not a problem that is just too hard to do. There have been very serious ideas in order to address the first order problem of Syria, which is Bashar al-Assad's violent repression of his people, and a repression that itself triggered ISIS, a repression that itself fed ISIS, that this administration has refused to address. This isn't Rob Sutloff's assessment. The ideas came from Hillary Clinton, from Leon Panetta, from the administration that the president rejected years ago. We are now, I think, reaping some of the fallout from refusing to address a problem seriously 3 or 4 years ago. Some of those solutions are still viable, such as creating an effective safe zone in northern and southern Syria so that these people do not have to flee their country, which is what the Assad-Russian strategy is to do, which is to get Syrians out of Syria. If you don't like the people, you get them out. That's what their strategy is. We can address this strategy.
Jeremy, how about it? Let's just look at safe zones for a moment. We'll go to the bigger picture. But are safe zones a kind of humanitarian move here, or would that be a move to deny a Russian/Assad victory because portions of Syria would just simply not be under their control?
Well, portions of Syria are not under their control right now. I think that all the humanitarian organizations are against the idea of safe zones. And the reason that they're against the idea of safe zones is because they understand that what it is an effort to prevent refugees from going into the neighboring countries, and that what would happen is that currently a lot of the refugees who are fleeing would end up in these safe zones. They would be under the protection, I guess, not in their homes because they would have fled from other parts of Syria, but they would be under some sort of international protection, which would be very uncertain. They would be miserable in those conditions, much as they are sort of miserable, but even more so than in Turkey and Jordan, because they would be without prospect for a future. And they would lack the international protections that come to them as being refugees. So essentially what the safe zones would do is not really affect the civil war in any way. They would just displace the refugee problem into Syria and make it worse for the people who are there.
Wouldn't they give anti-Assad rebels a base or a couple of bases protected by the United States?
They already have a base. They
not given air cover by the United States, not a no-fly zone.
They have Turkey and Jordan.
Yes, I mean in Syria, where they're now barrel-bombed.
They would have additional bases, but I don't think that would affect the civil war in any major way.
And what about the idea of a major strategic setback here with this emergence of a Russian-allied kind of a Shiite arc from Hezbollah in Lebanon all the way to Iran?
You know, I think that's something that really we need to worry about and think about in the way that Dr. Sutloff said. But the way to deal with it is not to involve yourself in a war which will sap your strength. I think the way to deal with it is to exploit the very real differences that exist between those parties, to recognize that they're not likely to be able to form an effective alliance, and to recognize that they're not fighting for things which are really worth having, and just Just getting bogged down in the Syrian civil war is not a prize which is likely to enhance either their alliance or their individual strength.
Is it now emerging as somehow inevitable that the U.S. will have to accept Assad long term? If he's got Russian support, he won't go away. Either he or his regime bringing order, which Putin wants, and state integrity. The U.S. has never really come up with an option. Does this push inexorably toward the U.S. accepting Assad despite the years of saying he must go?
Yeah, I think that it we might end up at least tacitly doing that. I would argue perhaps we already had, even before the Russian intervention. The issue really is not so much the survival of Assad, the individual, or even the survival of the Assad regime. It was always what would replace it. When you were looking at this problem when I was in the government, we never had an answer to that question. It was always conceivable that the United States, in combination with its allies, could end the Assad regime. I think we've learned in recent years that we're pretty good at destroying regimes. U.S. can do that. They could have done that in Syria. What they couldn't have done necessarily is replace it with anything that was better or more stabilizing. And that remains a problem today. I think it's an even more severe problem today. And so in those circumstances, you probably do have to sort of tacitly, I think not directly, not morally in any way, except that the Assad regime might continue, because I'm not sure you're really being responsible or moral if you end a regime without an effective plan for replacing it with something that will be better for the population and more stabilizing for the region.
And yet the U.S. has said again and again he must go. I want to turn in just a moment to Ambassador John Herbst. A couple of calls first. Mary in West Palm Beach, Florida. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I believe very strongly that I'm happy Russia is in Syria. Syria is Russia's ally. If this was Israel, we would have a legitimate reason to be in there. Russia has a legitimate reason to maintain Assad's regime. I think President Obama has had a plan from the beginning, and that was to form a coalition, which he did, to play a supporting role with no troops on the ground. I think we learned a bitter lesson in Iraq. If we remove a regime that is violent and inhumane, it's not going to work.
Mary, what if people look at Assad and say, well, there's a murderous tyrant whose oppression helped engender ISIS, and we just can't live with that. What about that argument?
Well, that argument is that once we bring stability, once Russia brings stability to the region, Assad will eventually be out. Evolution will take that man out of that. But it will be done, hopefully, in a stable way. It won't be done in a, okay, let's get him out. And who is getting in? And that's what happened in Iraq. There's so much instability. But Russia has a willingness to put troops on the ground to bring stability there. And we can just sit back and hope for the best, give our support. And I just think it's a much better, more peaceful way of doing this. And
not peaceful if you're under Russian bombs, but I take your point, and I think others will be tempted by that very perspective. We'll look at it. Mary, I appreciate your call. Robert Satloff, Jeremy Shapiro, please stand by. Ambassador John Herbst joins us now from Washington, director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Long career in the State Department until just a few years back. Former director of regional affairs in the State Department's Near East Bureau. That's what we're talking right here. Former ambassador to the Ukraine, to Uzbekistan. Served in embassies all over this region, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Russia, for that matter. Ambassador John Herbst, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. I think you just heard Mary there in Florida saying, let Russia bring stability and let a more natural, peaceful course of events work itself out. Maybe this is all just fine and dandy, Ambassador.
No, it's not fine and dandy. Syria is a snake pit. And in fact, President Obama is wise not to have gotten too involved there. Mr. Putin's intervention there, he will run free for 3 or 4 months, maybe 6 or 8, and he will strengthen the Assad regime. But eventually, ISIS will begin to tear away at the Assad regime, even supported by the Kremlin, and Mr. Putin will face a dilemma. But there's another aspect to this which hasn't been discussed, mm-hmm. and here I'm critical of the administration. In addition, Mr. Putin's principal objective in Syria, not his only one, is to bolster his longtime ally, the Assads. However, he's also deliberately embarrassing the United States in ways that are simply unacceptable. In fact, to stabilize Assad, the most important thing for him to do is go after ISIS. He's going after the rebels whom we've supported, who are very weak, in order to embarrass us. He's been going into Turkish airspace in order to embarrass us. This after, a year ago, he kidnapped an Estonian counterintelligence officer from Estonia to embarrass us in the Baltic region as he conducts his war in Ukraine. We have not been strong enough standing up to Russian aggression. And in fact, while I think the president is wise not to get too heavily involved in Syria because there is no acceptable and competent partner for us, he has to respond to the Kremlin's sharp actions against the United States.
But how does that play out, Ambassador? Because the U.S. coordinated with rebels on the ground that became understood to be U.S.-backed. If Russia was going to stabilize Assad, he would inevitably go after some of those. You're saying the U.S. would put their opponents of Assad out of bounds for Russia, but then Russia's – I mean, that pulls the plug on Putin's undertaking, doesn't it?
No, because the overwhelming challenge to Assad are not the weak fellows we support.
Mm-hmm.
The overwhelming challenge is ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda-affiliated group. So the fact that he's going after the rebels we've supported shows his intention is at least partly, again, to embarrass us and to make us look weak. So, for example, we can play that game. We could simply take out part of Assad's helicopter fleet, send a little message to Moscow, you touch our boys again, watch what we do to Assad. We should also be providing serious support within NATO to the Turks, put anti-aircraft equipment on the border with Syria, again, as a little warning to the Russians. That would not make us look weak. And again, the president is wise not to get too heavily involved in the Syrian civil war because, again, there's no competent, acceptable partner for us.
What if Russia takes down our fighter jets or whatever vehicle for that attack on Assad's helicopters and says, there's a message for you?
I think that's highly unlikely. Mr. Putin does not want to fight against American forces. Right now, he thinks he can bluff us. And he's done a pretty good job at that in the Baltic states and Ukraine. Now he's doing it in the Middle East. It's time for us to show that we are the real superpower.
Robert Satloff, we've got the former National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, is saying that there's only one option for the U.S. here, that Moscow has to cease and desist from any military actions that directly affect American assets, and if they don't, they should be disarmed by American military power. Would you go that far, Robert?
Well, again, that's not – I don't think that's the priority. I don't think that we should be picking a war with Putin, although Putin has certainly been feeding the proxy war against America's partners. Our priority should be what caused the tragedy in Syria. What is the top way to begin to put this back together? And that's focusing on the Assad regime. Who are the adversaries of the Assad regime? What are the weaknesses of the Assad regime? We can address this. We can arm our allies much better. We can support our local partners much better. And I think we should be effective at protecting the Syrian people wherever we are able to do so at an acceptable cost. And that is through safe zones, through no-fly zones near the Turkish border and the Jordanian border.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russia's big power play in Syria, the U.S. response, and where this all could go. With Robert Satloff, Jeremy Shapiro, and Ambassador John Herbst, the Obama administration taking lots of heat politically in the U.S. for sure. Here was Marco Rubio, GOP presidential candidate, Florida senator, in September, talking with NPR.
If I were president, we would provide a clear strategy to deal with ISIS. We would have done so already. And those nations would prefer to work with us. But if left with a choice between Russia and nothing, they're going to choose Russia.
And New Jersey Governor, Republican candidate Chris Christie, talking with MSNBC yesterday, asked how he would handle the situation with Russia's military. Here's what he had to say. Christie, yesterday.
My first phone call would be to Vladimir. And I'd say to him, listen, we're enforcing this no-fly zone. And I mean we're enforcing it against anyone, including you. So don't try me. Don't try me, because I'll do it.
You can join this conversation. Does the Obama team look lost or shrewd here? Should the U.S. let Russia have the region, this mess, or do we have to be and be seen to be strong? What would that mean here? Now, John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I just like to say Assad's been in power for years in this. This creation of ISIS came about because of the pullout of Iraq, which created a vacuum. And, like I said, Assad's been in power for years, and I don't see, you know, they're just defending their nation, you know.
Who? Who's they, John? Who's defending their nation?
Well, Assad was defending his nation. Now Russia's going to help him defend that nation, you know, against this assault from ISIS.
Let's look at some of the roots here. Ambassador Herbst, there's the assertion that it was the U.S. pullout, drawdown in Iraq that engendered ISIS. Others would say it was the U.S. going into Iraq that engendered ISIS. We've heard in this hour that it was Assad's brutality that engendered ISIS. What about the roots of ISIS and how it relates to this, Ambassador?
Well, certainly ISIS began as part of the resistance in Iraq after we went in. It was Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, and Jabhat al-Nusra came from there, and then ISIS emerged in the spring of 2012 in Syria. So it's all related to the chaos that ensued after we went into Iraq. But also it relates to the chaos that ensued in Syria after the people began to protest in March of 2011 and Assad cracked down brutally on peaceful demonstrators. That's what led to an armed resistance of which ISIS became the most powerful player within about a year and a half of the appearance of protests in Syria. So there are many, many strands leading to the emergence of ISIS. But right now it has the most momentum. It is the strongest player in the game in Syria.
Is it going to be turned around, or is everyone slowly just learning to live with the fact of this new state sitting there? If it's not going to stay, who's likely to take it out? Russia, the U.S., some coordinated action, or no one?
ISIS eventually will burn itself out. I think the efforts we've taken against ISIS have not been strong enough or methodical enough, but I'm not certain we'd be able to do it unless we were willing to put tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of troops on the ground, which no one wants. Russia will not be successful in its intervention. And within a year and a half, certainly at the outside, Mr. Putin will be regretting the fact that he said he was going to intervene and ensure that Assad's staying in power. But at the moment, his play does not look bad.
Daniel in Montreal, Canada. Daniel, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Very interesting discussion. I'd just like to make a few points. Russia's actions in the region are entirely rational, and they have a historic base. Russia, under the Tsars, considered itself the protector of the Christians of the Middle East. Russia sees its naval base on the Mediterranean coast as crucial to its projection of power. And it has a long-standing alliance with Assad, who you referred to earlier as a brutal dictator.
Well, we've seen the barrel bombs, we've seen the death toll.
Well, we've certainly seen that, and that doesn't make him a nice guy. But if we're comparing him to people like the Saudi regime and the mass murder going on in Yemen and the Turkish destruction of large sections of the Kurdish population in its war against their movement for independence, this is a tough regime, and it is Russia's ally, if we're looking for people that we don't like, there could be loss in the region. As to stopping ISIS, I suggest your guests consider Grozny these days, which has been remarkably subdued by Russian force, brutally and effectively. And I think that they're in for a surprise if they think that Russia is not in this as a serious long-term game. I would also say if you wanted to stop ISIS, probably the first thing that the U.S. would do if it were really serious about stopping ISIS, as opposed to tolerating it as a tool of chaos to granulate regimes like Syria,
yep.
The first thing it would do would call in the ambassadors of Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan. Say any collaboration with these fighters will be met with violence.
You mean what, bombing Riyadh? What do you mean by that?
I'm saying that if you look to the source of Wahhabist, extremist, jihadist violence, it comes right back to Riyadh, that the jihadists have been moving across the border. This is well known. Out of Jordan, out of Turkey, they've had frontier passage, safe passage.
Yeah, Daniel, you put a lot on the table there. Jeremy Shapiro, pretty soon one starts to get dizzy. I mean, are you bombing Assad or are you bombing Riyadh? Who's your ally? Who's your enemy? Do you feel sympathy with Russia because they've got this on their doorstep? I mean, Chechnya is about as close to Raqqa as Raqqa is to Jordan.
I think that one of the things we have to come to terms with in the Middle East is that we don't really, outside of Israel, we don't really have any real friends. One of the few things that people across the Arab Middle East spectrum agree with is that the United States is not their ally. And we have, friends and we have partners that we sometimes work with on a transactional basis. But it's hard to sort of locate the Jeffersonian democracy, the Democrats in most of these countries. Now, I mean, I'm not comfortable with the way that the caller referred to Assad, who I think is a brutal dictator and has demonstrated that he is somewhat worse than pretty much anybody else in the region. And that's an important moral point to keep in mind. But having said that, it's hard to be very attracted to the model in Saudi Arabia. It's hard to be very attracted to the model in most of the Arab states these days. And I think we need to understand that we don't have a lot of true allies in the region, and we have to deal with that on a very transactional basis.
But that's been the case for a long, long time. If we now are seen to be taking a back seat to Moscow, and Moscow turns Syria into a new Chechnya, a new Grozny, which kind of just level things until there's quietude, and the U.S. is playing some second fiddle or no fiddle role. What does that mean for the future of the region and U.S.?
I think we need to be very clear, and I think all three of us have said it in a variety of ways, mm-hmm. that the Russian intervention in Syria is bad all around. It is not good for the United States. It is not good for, as most of all, not good for Syria and the region. And it's even worse, I think, ultimately, for Russia. Syria is not Chechnya. It is not part of Russia. The Russia does not have the capacity, as Ambassador Hirsch has emphasized, to project force there for a really long time and to win the civil war, not just against ISIS, but against the 100,000 or 200,000 non-ISIS opposition fighters who've been fighting very hard and for a very long time. And I don't think, they can do a lot to stabilize the Assad regime and make sure it doesn't fall, but they really can't end that civil war.
But the Obama reaction seems to be a kind of a shrug. Let it burn itself out. Is that how you read it? And what does that mean?
I don't read it as a shrug, but I do read it as recognizing that simply because Russia does something bold and stupid, it doesn't make sense to respond with something that's equally bold and equally stupid. You have to come up with a solution that's going to make the problem better. And I think that most of the proposals that have come out self-evidently wouldn't do that. Now, I do agree with Ambassador Herbst that Russia has set out to embarrass Obama and the United States in this and has done so, and that requires a response. But I think that response should be one that doesn't end up embroiling the United States in a proxy war in Syria, which it self-evidently doesn't want to fight.
So what would it look like, that response that is that sort of checks Russia somehow but doesn't embroil? What would that look like?
I think so. Part of what Ambassador Herbst said I would agree with, which is that we need to have a very strong response in Turkey, which reinforces Turkey in terms of anti-aircraft, but also in terms of other assistance, and reinforces other regional states to help contain the Syrian civil war and to help strengthen their relationship with the United States. But I think that the last thing that we want to do is respond to embarrassment by getting involved in a Syrian civil war, which we can't really affect in a positive way and which won't help our interests.
Robert Satloff, would
risk escalation with the Russians.
Would a safe zone or safe zones, no-fly zones, north and south, embroil the U.S. in the Syrian civil war more deeply?
Well, it would reflect a much greater engagement in this conflict, but it wouldn't actually require us to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers to the ground in Syria, which is the false choice that many of the advocates of the administration always raise. The president himself, if you listen to the rest of that 60 Minutes interview, goes on to suggest, his critics all say that we should send hundreds of thousands of troops back to the Middle East, but that's absolutely not true. There are things that we can do effectively through the measured use of U.S. power to restore some sense to our alliances, to support the fighters on the ground, to give safe areas so that people don't have to, so that Assad doesn't succeed in depopulating his country, which is going on in unprecedented ways. This is a strategic threat to us. This isn't just a humanitarian challenge.
But wouldn't that require being as present as Russia is right now, which Obama is calling a foolish presence? Wouldn't we have to have, much, much denser air support, for example, for allies and against Assad than we have had?
We have years of experience of doing no-fly zones effectively. What people forget is that we did this in Iraq very quietly, very effectively for many years, and Saddam was denied access to large swaths of his country. We know how to do this. And so to suggest that the only way to do this is by sending 100,000 troops deployed in Syrian territory, that is not being fair to our men and women uniform and not being fair and leveling with the American people.
Ambassador Herbst, is the Obama administration stupidly sitting on its hands here when there are obvious, easy things that could be done that would change the situation on the ground? Is he pleading we can't when we could?
Again, I would commend the administration for not getting involved in the civil war despite some serious political pressure in Washington to do so. I've also said we need to respond to the Russian provocations against us. If we wanted to do something serious for the people who are suffering in Syria, we could establish a safe haven. However, a safe haven would require serious troops on the ground. They would not be American troops. Maybe we could persuade some of our European friends who have this great immigration crisis, especially the French, to put troops on the ground. There's no question if we just tried to establish a safe haven with air power that both ISIS and provocateurs from the Assad regime would be able to get in and indiscriminately create mayhem. So you need to have troops on the ground to protect a safe haven. But that could be a joint project for the United States and European partners, and also, for that matter, with Turkey. Because Turkey would have an interest to establishing a safe haven in Syria to reduce the pressure of refugees in Turkey. That would demonstrate leadership, address both strategic and humanitarian concerns.
Zbigniew Brzezinski last week brought up the frightening image of World War I. Lots of people playing around with guns and all crisscrossed interests, and suddenly things get out of control. I mean, you get French troops in there and U.S. air cover and Russian fighter jets and all the rest. Is it overwrought to see this as some kind of powder keg that may spiral out of the seems to be sort of loose strategic control or insight of the players here, Ambassador?
Brzezinski is one of the great strategic minds of this century or the last two centuries. So you have to listen to him with great respect. I am, however, not persuaded by a World War I analogy. We've heard a lot of these analogies over the past several years in a variety of circumstances, because ultimately the interests of the United States and Russia are not nearly as great in Syria as were the interests of Russia, England, France, Austria-Hungary in Central Europe and the concatenation of events that led to World War I.
Robert Satloff, where do you think this goes? You see the Obama administration, they're in for a while longer. I don't know what a Clinton or a Rubio or a Trump administration would do. What do you see unfolding here?
Well, I think the next 16 months matter a lot.
Long time.
Whether the balance of the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
And so if during this period the Russians are successful in shoring up the Assad regime, creating an effective, stable, smaller Alawite statelet, and in B, destroying any American-backed, Western-backed opposition to Assad. So all that is left is ISIS in the east of Syria and the Russian-backed, Iranian-backed Iran in the west. Then we're in a very different and, I think, much worse strategic situation.
Jeremy Shapiro, likelihood of that?
The likelihood that the Russians will succeed at establishing a stable statelet in Syria, I think, it's not very likely. I think that the Russians have bitten off more than they can chew. I think that we will continue to have this Syrian problem. And what I would really worry about is the prospects for escalation. I think that what we've already seen from the TOW missiles is a counter-escalation by the U.S., but certainly by its partners in the region, and the Russians and Iranians will respond to that, and we will yet continue this cycle.
A lot at play. Choose your bet. Jeremy Shapiro, thank you for joining us today. Robert Satloff at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Ambassador John Herbst. Our thanks to you all. What a picture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.